Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So this is not the kind of thing that I usually do research on. As he said, I mainly do ancient Greek philosophy. But for the last few years, I've been thinking about sort of race things in the United States and trying to understand them. So what I'm going to offer you are, as I was telling Father Jerome, the kind of half-baked ideas, not fully baked ideas. And what I'm hoping for is I'll say something that is sufficiently provocative and interesting that you'll have some questions for me and help me kind of just work out whatever sort of issues or weaknesses I have in what I'm going to offer. So what I'm going to attempt here is not to do actually offer you things that are prescriptive in the sense of this is what you should do and this is how you should be. I'll gesture towards that right at the end of the talk. But what I want to attempt, and this is my idea of what makes for good philosophy, is sort of describe a phenomenon that I think we're all sort of navigating or under its power, and see what we can sort of think about this. And so the thing on our minds, at least on my mind, is race and the way it sort of works itself out, specifically in the United States, but maybe more broadly in Western democracies. And I think I can at least say at the beginning that when we see how it works in society, something's off, all right? That we're not exactly sure what this thing is, but it makes us say funny things, it makes us do funny things. And what I'm going to attempt to do is maybe explain maybe what is going on. So for example, right, we might think about, you know, the poor choices that millennials who are not from the United States have to choose and how they act relative to race. So for example, when I was coming to the United States for undergrad, a very long time ago, I had to figure out what box I was going to check, right, on the kind of race survey. And one of the boxes was, well, black, African-American. It's like, well, is that the same thing? I'm not sure. And I was sufficiently confused. I said, I'll just check other. That seems safe. whereas Zoram Mamdani, he checked black because for some reason, he thought that this was the thing to do. All right. And we want to maybe figure out that why would that be the thing to do? So at least in my mind, someone coming from outside the United States, I sort of feel like a stranger in a strange land, trying to sort of navigate in these categories. I didn't really grow up with them very strongly. And at least over the last, let's say, 10-ish years, but especially the last 5 years, things seem to just kind of hit a higher level of intensity and focus about this. And not just sort of secularly, but even Catholic philosophers and theologians want to talk about this. So I have here titles of 3 recent articles, and we will not discuss the names of the authors. We'll just kind of let that lie in ambiguity and cover the sins of Noah, maybe, if you're not into these things. But the titles are just in themselves sort of interesting, okay? So one, and these are people that I think are essentially Orthodox people, like Orthodox Catholics. So one wrote an article on how whiteness is an ecclesiological heresy, and another wrote on whiteness and religious experience, trying to explain that white people have this special vulnerability to a kind of pernicious spiritual attitude that's going to corrupt their perception, corrupt their imagination, their memory, their wills. And this is a kind of interesting reading of categories in John of the Cross being kind of applied to whiteness as something. Someone else wrote about black lives and the preferential option for the poor. The idea being, well, if you are in the United States or Western democracy currently, you should maybe learn to see black people or perhaps persons of color as the poor in some sense, so that you'll be moved to sort of care for them, take care of them, honor them, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the interesting things is there are weird cultural tensions even with positions like this, okay? So, for example, even though at least a couple of these people want to think of whiteness as this heresy or this religious experience that's corrupted, at least the way people talk it's not just white people who are sort of susceptible to whiteness. So presumably you've heard about people talking about internalized whiteness. So even black people or persons of color can come under the pernicious effects of this whiteness thing, and it can corrupt these innocent people, and that's sort of scary. But also the kind of preferential option for the poor thing doesn't please a lot of black people, because it tends to lead to this sort of posture where white people start looking at themselves as like the main characters, right, in the great racial story. And the black people are the POCs, are kind of like NPCs, they're there to be helped. And then you as a nice white person kind of do quests for them so that you kind of get, they feel better or something like that. And people usually call that like, you know, being a white savior, and that's presumably bad, right? So there's weird tensions, incoherences. And you know, one thing, if this talk is interesting, even if it's not, you should go and check out White Savior Barbie's Instagram after this talk. It's one of my favorite Instagram accounts. So this is just like the kind of confusions we're trying to navigate generally. But even a couple of months ago, so this summer, The Pillar, so Pillar Catholic, they put out an interesting article on an Marian apparition in Rwanda. And in their explanation of it, just as a throwaway line, they say, well, if we better understand this, well, we'll come to know better Black Catholic spirituality. All right. And I remember reading that line and stopping and thinking, what in the world is Black Catholic spirituality? I don't think anyone really thinks of, say, Italian devotions as white Catholic spirituality. So why would normal people talk this way? Right. Is sort of the thing that is kind of going through my mind. Right. You don't really look at, you know, Spanish devotions like, oh, yeah, that's white Catholicism or something, or white spirituality. So what is going on when people do things like this is kind of what I'm playing with. Now, one of the things that's going to frame what I am doing is the work of a couple of African-American scholars, all right? So their names are Karen and Barbara Fields. So they've put together a collection of essays in a book that's called Racecraft, right? And I suggest, if you can, to go and kind of pick it up. It's really super interesting. And one of the things that they do is something that is near and dear to the heart of any philosopher, is they give us some definitions, and definitions are kind of helpful for us. So for example, when they're trying to figure out, well, what do people mean when they talk about race? Well, they say that race, quote, stands for the conception or the doctrine that nature produced humankind in distinct groups, each defined by inborn traits that its members share and that differentiate them from the members of other distinct groups of the same kind, but of unequal rank. So they seem to think just the way race works in society, you already end up sort of treating people unequally for whatever reason, okay? And then they say, well, what is racism? Racism refers to the theory and practice of applying a social, civic, or legal double standard based on ancestry and to the ideology surrounding such a double standard. So that's kind of straightforward. What they are contributing is this idea of racecraft, okay? Because what they want to offer us as an idea is that most people go around thinking, well, there were races out there, and then what happened was the racist showed up and started treating the races differently, okay? And so racism is downstream of races. That's how they think most people think. Their theory is it actually goes in the opposite direction, okay? It's by doing racism that you produce races, all right? And that the whole creation of the races was a racist act. And we continually do things in our day-to-day sort of lives where we're continually finding ways to keep these categories alive, all right? That we do these things primarily politically in the way we speak, the way we act with each other, the kind of policies that we have, the kind of laws that we have. And we're just kind of doing this continually, right, as a society. And so they say racecraft, this crafting of race, is essentially this sort of mental terrain and pervasive belief that we're kind of participating in. And in their minds, it occupies a middle ground between science and superstition, because sometimes we seem to think that the races are kind of scientific categories, but at the other times we're like, well, no, not really, they're super weird, because people end up saying weird things. And there's this invisible realm of collective understandings that we all share, right? I mean, we go through life in the Western democracies basically seeing race all the time, right? Some people might claim that they don't see it. I don't believe them. It's just how life is for us, right? We see people, they come under this category, and we often treat them in funny ways according to these categories. And they say it's like a half-lit zone in the mind's eye. So much is okay. Okay, what I want to do is say things are actually more interesting than even they maybe appreciate. And what I have in mind is when contemporary people use racial categories for the most part, what they tend to do is take these categories and then they apply them in any sorts of ways into the world. Often they apply it to things happening now, but at least if you sort of suffer through scholarship like I do, you see them applying in any sorts of interesting ways. So there's any number of articles about how, guess what, like even the Vikings were white and racist and stuff. Or if you look at Catholics and we have this desire, right, that Augustine be black, right? Of course, Augustine has never thought of himself as black. No one around Augustine thought Augustine was black. But for us, it's important that Augustine is black. And we need to sort of, we're going to paint him in a new way than maybe we did before. And I'm like, well, what's going on? Why do we just sort of, again, assume the reality of these categories and then end up just applying them contemporarily, but also historically to any number of things? So what I want to propose, this is now the crazy move, rather than do what people typically do, which is take the categories more or less as a given, apply them to the world, present or historical, I want to say, well, what would it look like if someone actually from the past, before these categories existed, so someone who's operating outside of these categories, were to look at our situation and then diagnose what is happening, all right, sort of discuss and what is going on. So I've picked Augustine as my guy because I just like him very much. But also because I like the city of God. And in my mind, so this is the teaser for everything that's going to happen going forward. What he says about demons in the city, okay, more or less maps almost perfectly in my mind the way we deal with race. Okay, so Augustinian political demonology, all right, is the frame I am proposing to you for understanding the weird pathologies we have in navigating race and everything that sort of flows from that in our society, okay? So that's the idea, that's the big idea, and you will tell me at the end of this attempt what you think about it, all right? So let's kind of make some moves about this. One of the things that I think is relatively clear to me is we're just not sure what race is, all right? That the moment you try and stop and try and sort of grasp it, you realize that this thing is very slippery. And in my mind, what good philosophy does, ideally, is it makes you stop, pay attention, and notice things, all right? And I think Augustine would be sort of very helpful towards making us stop, pay attention, and notice. So one of the things we just need to kind of admit from the get-go is how weird this category is. So I have here a couple of quotations from the US government census, all right? So this is how the government thinks about race in the United States, okay? And this is what we say. The racial categories, this is on the document itself, the racial categories included in the census questionnaire generally reflect a social definition of race recognized in this country and not an attempt to define race biologically, anthropologically, genetically. Basically, they're saying, we don't know what this is, but we assume people know, and we'll go with that, all right? That's basically what's going on there. In addition, it is recognized that the categories of the race item include racial and national origin, so somehow racial is even within the understanding of race, the racial and national origin or sociocultural groups. People may choose to report, so crucially, the government just deals with self-reporting because they have no way of actually checking what race you belong to because they don't know what this thing is and no one really knows what this thing is. So you have to self-report, okay? That's how it sort of measures. So people may choose to report more than one race, that's interesting, to indicate their racial mixture, such as American Indian and white, People who identify their origin as Hispanic, Latino, or Spanish may be of any race, in fact. Then you might ask, okay, what are white people? Well, according to the government, a white person is a person having origins in any of the original peoples of Europe, the Middle East, North Africa. All right, that is a pretty big swath of people. And they're not culturally connected, they're not genetically connected, they're not linguistically connected. So you have to ask, what makes them white? They even look different, frankly. So what's the thing that's joining them? Now you're like, what's going on? What makes a black person, according to the government? Well, it says it is a person having origins in any of the black racial groups of Africa. They don't know what makes you black. They'll just say, you had to come from the black people. That's what makes you black. You're like, okay, that's very helpful. So what does this tell us? Well, it tells us that this thing does not really track any natural phenomenon. Okay, that is sort of easily observable. But even more interestingly than that, it doesn't even track any artificial phenomenon well enough, all right? So usually people do a little song and dance and they say, well, race is a social construct. And we're like, yes, race is a social construct. But lots of social constructs are actually pretty clear, okay? So for example, stoplights are a social construct and you know how to recognize them and you know how to act relative to them. All right. Borders of countries are social constructs, and they're relatively well to sort of note, and you know where they are, where they begin, where they end, etc. But we're dealing here with a social construct that is so slippery that no one is taking responsibility for defining it. All right. But at the same time, we all just trust that we know what we're talking about. Okay. And that's kind of one of the weird things, or one of the interesting things. Now, for understanding this, I am going to say we should maybe look towards ancient authors. And very quickly, one of the things that is interesting in my mind is that in Plato's Republic, Socrates says, well, the city will be really helped if we can come up with this noble lie. And this noble lie will do a couple of things. It'll help unify the city and therefore stabilize it against sort of internal strife. But it will also help us to hierarchically sort people, all right? And we'll give certain privileges to people at the top, certain privileges to people at the bottom. But Socrates, he grants this, that this thing is false, it's a lie. But he hopes, he says, when he's talking to his interlocutors, he says, well, how then could we devise one of those useful lies we were talking about a while ago? A single grand lie that would preferably persuade even the rulers themselves, but failing that, at least the rest of the city. So it says, in an ideal situation, not only would the sort of people be kind of under the power of the lie, but if it's really successful, even the leaders start believing in it. And he says, and then he speaks to his interlocutor and says, do you know how to make that happen? And the interlocutor says, well, no, but I think I have a mechanism that we can sort of apply later to sort of pull this off. My proposal is that race is one of these things. It's something that's just actually fundamentally false, but we've bought it, and even the leaders have bought it, right? So the kind of thing that Plato's theorizing about and is wondering if anyone could ever pull off, we've pulled it off, all right? And that's something kind of cool and interesting about us. But then there's Augustine. And Augustine's sort of writing the City of God, which is sort of downstream of the Republic, he's thinking about how princes or people or leaders in the city themselves can use false myths to knit the city together and therefore have more people under their power, all right? So this is how he describes it. Just as the demons cannot possess any but those whom they have deceived with guile, so also men in princely office, not indeed being just, but like demons, have persuaded the people in the name of religion to receive as true those things which they themselves knew to be false, in this way, as it were, binding them up more firmly in civil society, so that they might in like manner possess them as subjects. And then he earlier on goes on to say, yet by this crafty device, the malign demons are wonderfully delighted, and they come to possess alike the deceivers, so the simple people, and the leaders and the simple people, i.e. the deceived. So When you do stuff like this in the city, according to Augustine, you're imitating demons. And as you imitate the demons, you become like them and fall under their power. Okay. Also sort of interesting is that Augustine thinks that cities that are founded on these false myths, they have a kind of fratricidal character. All right? There's this idea that you end up kind of doing violence to your brother in some way. So in his mind, he's thinking of Cain and Abel, and Cain as the founder of the first city, and that's a city that's founded on human blood. He's also thinking about Remus on Romulus, and that's also a city, Rome, founded on blood. And I think in some ways it also just tracks with the noble lie in the Republic, because to sort of get this thing running, you sort of have to dominate these people in some way and sort of hierarchically sort them, and there's certain things that people at the bottom will just not be able to do and not allowed to do, all right? So this kind of myth that binds the city nevertheless has this sort of fratricidal character, that it's violence against those next to you, those who are among you. Okay. Now, beyond this sort of lie character, this false thing that we're that has us under its power, it's also these categories, I think, are an expression of what Augustine calls this lust for conquest, this libido dominandi. And this is now goes back to this idea about the way the categories of race came about, right? So these are not historical categories in the sense of they don't go back all the way to ancient times or to sort of a kind of theoretical state of nature. As we use these categories today, like whiteness and blackness and so on, these categories belong to the early modern world, right? So slave trade and kind of the way in which a number of societies found ways to sort of codify the oppression, right? So once you bring these slaves over and then you want to turn them into a permanent slave class, you generate these categories for sorting the white and the black, all right? And so that you can sort of more stably and maybe in perpetuity sort of dominate the black class, all right? So the genealogy of these categories is a genealogy of violence, right? So sort of this fratricidal character. And for Augustine, again, even just the way the Romans treat the rape of the Sabine women is kind of similar. This is something that is sort of for the strength of Rome, makes Rome more powerful and more stable. Here we see something similar that we sort of invented and imposed, right? No one gets born, right, naturally black or white the way we use these characters. My experience of them is you sort of cross the border and enter into the United States, then all of a sudden, you realize, oh, this is how people look at me, and this is how people are going to treat me. And you don't have any say in that. The category just sort of gets imposed upon you because you realize this is just how everyone here lives, all right? Now, Augustine, when discussing how the Roman Empire expands, he says, it'll be really helpful for them if they can have devotion to what he calls essentially like the god of foreign iniquity. All right, that a God that allows them to believe in the lowness or the evil of the enemy of the Romans. All right, because if you have a kind of God to whom you can serve this way, it's much more easy to rationalize, right, the violence you do against them, the kind of imperial project that you're doing against them. And so he says, if therefore, by carrying on wars that were just, not impious or unrighteous, the Romans could have acquired so great an empire, ought they not to worship as a goddess even the injustice of foreigners, like this god of foreign iniquity? For we see that this has cooperated much in extending the empire by making foreigners so unjust they became people with whom just wars might be carried on and the empire increased. So what I'm proposing essentially is that these categories in their sort of early variant were ways for rationalizing the sort of violence that was done to the enslaved peoples, and then say post that in the Reconstruction era or something. But even today, there's a weird, interesting way that even anti-racist, at least excessive anti-racist activity operates on the same logic, right? This logic allows you once again to sort of rationalize acts that would be, at least in other contexts, sort of suspect or perhaps unjust. So the example I'm going to go with here is from Abram Kendi, who, you know, famously wrote that the only remedy to racist discrimination is anti-racist discrimination. The only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination, and the only remedy to present discrimination is future discrimination. What I'm basically offering you is that there's something weird about these categories, especially when it comes to white and black, that they're just continually in tension, right? Initially, generally speaking, it was white had power over black. Now we're in a much more kind of mixed thing where, depending on the special context you are, white will be over black, and then other contexts, black will be over white. But they never really neatly actually just get treated as equal. Whenever they get used in a serious political way, there's often just moves being made towards, you want to give power to one side of this and remove power from the other side of this. That they're just continually in this tension, all right? And this is sort of going on this idea that on the one hand, the Romans have the idea of their gods and why they are good. On the other hand, they have this notion, this goddess of how their enemies are bad and always bad and therefore need to be dominated in some way. And so what happens then is politics, at least if it's under this power, is essentially a politics of envy, all right? And I mean sort of envy in the classical sense, which is to say you advance or you build yourself up by diminishing or destroying the other, okay? That what is good for you or what is advantageous for you is predicated on taking something from someone else. This is how racism worked in its sort of OG form. It's how it works now, whichever side of the kind of aisle that we're on. So we're kind of bound because of these categories in continual politics of envy. Like for one to go up, the other has to go down, all right? And this sort of just tells us that this thing is fundamentally unstable. Right, then they're just, it might not be possible to actually harmonize these things well. Okay, from that, then we can now notice some even more weird and interesting things about these categories, which is how do we end up keeping them alive, right? These categories have been with us for centuries now, and it doesn't look like we're any closer to getting rid of them. Now, the Field sisters, they say one of the interesting things about race is our political action and our political imagination is continually shifting, so that race as an idea is all the time being imagined, acted upon, reimagined, and the action and the imagining and reimagining are kind of inextricably intertwined, that every day, we're finding new and new ways to kind of keep these things alive. And just give you some examples, right? So if you were to ask someone today in the United States, well, how does someone actually become black? Well, at least as far as the United States is concerned, we have the one drop rule, all right? And if you just stop and attend for a moment, you should just wonder, why should that make anyone black? Okay, why is it the case that in our logic, right, that if you just have a relatively recent black ancestor, that somehow colors your whole kind of your whole line. So we sort of treat, in a certain way, the white position as kind of the clean one in some way, or the kind of more pure one, and then just the smallest drop of black somehow changes you and all your descendants. And this made sense as a rule, in a certain sense, in the times of slavery, because this is a way of making sure that you could own people, right? And so you'd own their children and own their children because you could keep them in this class of black. But we still actually operate according to this logic, and we should be asking ourselves, do we still want to be acting according to old slaver logic when we are articulating why someone is black or someone is white? But that's just, again, what we do. Also interesting is Jim Crow laws, right? One of the things that these laws were, they were not just targeting black people, but one of the things that they are doing is precisely by keeping these people separate, they help sort of solidify the idea that they should be separate, all right? And at least as far as, then there's any kind of weird little myths that we have about whiteness and blackness today. That there's this notion about race treachery, that if you have certain kinds of ideas, these are ideas that make you less black or not really black or not appropriately black. Or if you have different kinds of ideas, then maybe, you know, you're a traitor to white people or something. So, but if you stop and you think for a second, none of this follows logically, okay? But it's just a kind of pageant that we continually do to maintain the reality of these categories. The very idea that you know, in our generosity, we've expanded, right, blackness now to some more general thing, POCs, persons of color. And, you know, I'm just not sure exactly what is gained and why you're supposed to feel a kind of pride in being a POC. It's, I mean, in my mind, it just, again, sounds like you're being othered, right, relative to, again, the thing that's really in the primary position, which is obviously the white. And so culturally speaking, right, we keep doing these weird things. And one version of this that happened relatively recently was the African American Museum in DC put out this famous graphic. I don't know how many of you guys have seen this, that is trying to articulate whiteness and white culture in the United States. And it lists a bunch of things as white culture. And so I've named, you know, some of the choice ones. Self-reliance, right, is apparently white, the nuclear family, hard work, planning for the future, delayed gratification, objective, rational, linear thinking, cause and effect relationships, noting those, that these are things that apparently are white culture, all right? And so the idea is, I guess, that if you're into this sort of stuff, then you're diminished as black, I don't know. But it's super weird, okay, because you're kind of policing, right, in many ways, what you can do as black. And if you somehow, these things are somehow inappropriate for you as black, whereas these evil white people are imposing this on the POCs. But even just more broadly, at least in academic land, there's a huge fight a few years ago where there's this interesting woman who wrote this article for a feminist journal. And the thrust of the article was, well, if we allow transgenderism, we should also allow transracialism, okay? And the article got accepted and was published, but once it came out, there was just an amazing backlash, right? People saying, how dare you think this? This is evil, you're dangerous. The journal retracted the article and obviously did a little mea culpa tour explaining that these are dangerous ideas. And so this is interesting irony that in a culture where I think more or less people are willing to grant that there's probably something biological about sex and gender, hence why we're trying to do all of these affirming surgeries and stuff, but we can definitely change that. We are so invested in making sure people cannot change their races, okay? And it has to be because there's some kind of power game going on, right? And you don't want people to sort of opt out of some of the kind of things that are implicated here. And you want to keep the white people in a certain box, you know, keep the POCs in their box, never the two shall meet. And so again, we kind of go through these various kind of liturgical actions, essentially, like it's public action. You can't as an individual really opt out of this thing, okay? We're just under its power. It's in our language, it's in our policies, and you're just continually, day by day, forced to participate in this weird liturgy where we make, invent, and maintain the fiction that is race. but one special part of this, our liturgical life of race, is what I think Augustine would call theurgy, okay? So the Field Sisters say, one of the reasons why this thing gets maintained is because there is something strategic to it, that intelligent people keep opting into this. Intelligent people keep acting according to these things, even though if you sort of force them to stop and think, they will recognize it's a lie, all right? So there, for some reason, this thing is strategically valuable, all right? And Augustine, you know, one of the unfortunate moments when he's throwing some shade on the Platonists, goes after them as practitioners of theurgy, all right? Now, what is theurgy? Theurgy is a bunch of basically technical activities, public activities that you would do so that you could summon and use the power of spirits so that you could make your life better, basically, is the idea. I know, sounds great. And Augustine is like, these crazy people and they're flipping demons. So this is how he describes theurgy in the City of God. And Porphyry is a famous Platonist. He is probably Augustine's most evil Platonist, public enemy number one. And what Augustine is doing in this paragraph, he's like, it's so interesting. Porphyry is smart. Like, that's why he sort of likes Porphyry at the same time. He's like a frenemy. He's like, he's smart. He gets that these things are kind of fake, but he still nevertheless is compelled to sort of support them because other sort of layman Neoplatonists are definitely doing theurgy. So this is what Augustine has to say. Porphyry promises some kind of purgation of the soul by the help of theurgy, though he does so with some hesitation and shame, and denies that this art can secure to anyone a return to God, so that you can detect his opinion vacillating between the profession of philosophy and an art which he feels to be presumptuous and sacrilegious. He acknowledges, however, that these theurgic mysteries impart to the intellectual soul no such purity as fits it to see its God and recognize the things that truly exist. And from this acknowledgement, we may infer what kind of gods these are and what kind of vision of them is imparted by theurgic consecrations, if by it one cannot see the things which truly exist. So Augustine has three things he wants to kind of point out about this. Number one, he calls it an art. So it's a human art. It's kind of technical. There's things you just have to do. So there's a kind of mechanistic side to this, that if you do X as an input, you should get Y as an output, is the idea. So number one, okay, it's a human art. Second is this concern about pollution and purification, that people do this so that they can purify themselves, all right? But then the consequence, Augustine says, is instead what tends to happen is they become blinded to what is actually true, the things that actually exist. So my proposal to you is we do theurgic arts with our racecraft, all right? Both at the individual level and in the kind of corporate level as societies. Jim Crow laws are one example of these ways of sort of just segregating people politically so we can sort of pull this off. Another way that we do this, at least like more recently, when something bad happens and we're all sort of anxious about our whiteness, say, well, or our whatever, we go and, you know, we put our black squares up onto Instagram. And if we do this, we're like, okay, I'm a better person. I'm not guilty of that whiteness thing. And I feel maybe hopefully a bit purer. We also do this at a kind of corporate level. Okay, so every so often, right, Black History Month, every company dutifully puts some blackface onto its logo, and by this you kind of colorize yourself and show that we are a pure company, we are a good company, even as we exploit you. And then obviously land acknowledgements, right, is again, it's a public act which we do to just show, once again, we're working through the trauma of the bad things that people connected to us did before. We're not going to give up the land, but we are going to underline how badly it makes us feel, and we want to be purified of that. And then there's various ways in which, just you notice in our speech, individual and corporate, where we say stuff like, well, we need to sort of center minority voices because they have like a privileged position, a privileged special wisdom that we impure white people don't have. And what is going through these things continually, it's a way of conferring a kind of power to one side of the equation and hoping to achieve some kind of purification. But what Augustine points out is these things are ineffectual. And we can see that ours are also ineffectual. And what's the evidence that they're ineffectual? Because we keep doing them, all right? That you keep having to figure out what's the new square to do. Every year you have to sort of recolor the logo of your country, of your company. You keep doing the land acknowledgement even though it changes nothing. So we go through these things continually, publicly, and we have ways of just sort of nodding along as the thing is happening. But it's endless performance without any real purification, all right? And so Augustine says this is straight up theurgy, that there's a spectacle, right? There's a show that's going on, but it doesn't actually substantively bring anything about, okay? Now, the thing though I want to sort of focus on as I close is this concern he has at the end about people getting blinded, all right? Now, Augustine's a fantastic philosopher, he's a fantastic theologian, but I would say what he really is, an exegete of scripture, that what he's often doing is taking the language and the categories of scripture and then trying to apply them to the world as he sees it, all right? And something that he notes about demon worship in Rome, in the Roman Empire, is that fundamentally, this worship of idols tends to incline in a destructive direction. And this means fundamentally, it kind of ends up in issuing in human sacrifice, okay? So this is what he says. But if anyone insists that he worships the one true God, that is the creator of every soul and of every body, with stupid and monstrous idols, with human victims, human sacrifice, with putting a wreath on the male organ and the wages of unchastity, with a cutting of limbs, with emasculation, with the consecration of effeminates, with impure and obscene plays, such a one does not sin because he worships one who ought not to be worshipped. So these people might be trying to do the right thing. However, they're in the wrong because he worships him who ought to be worshipped in a way in which he ought not to be worshipped. That this is false worship. This is dangerous and destructive. And again, just generally speaking, before we kind of look at some scripture passages that I think are in play in this passage, if we look at just the whole history of race, that human sacrifice actually tends to be a feature in various ways, right? In the kind of classical version, let's say, there are just any number of ways of violating people, whether it was rape or lynching and kinds of destruction. Just the whole history of racial discrimination is part of ways in which you sort of subjugate people and offer people to the idol of race. And then for us, more contemporarily, you know, small h human sacrifice, so to speak, where if someone says the wrong thing, someone does the wrong thing, then we figure out ways to ostracize them, exile them, socially execute them. That this is just part of this kind of destructive pattern or matrix that we are in. Now, Augustine in this thing connects three ideas that I want to focus on: idolatry, human sacrifice, and unchastity, which is, I think, traditional sort of Old Testament themes, that these things all tend to converge. And to explain why, let's look at a couple of psalms, okay? So Psalm 115, we read from the psalmist describing the effect of idol making and idol worship. These people's idols are silver and gold, even the work of men's hands. They have mouths and do not speak. They have eyes and do not see. They have ears and hear not. Noses have they and smell not. They have hands and handle not. Feet they have and walk not. Neither speak they through their throat. Psalm 135. As for the images of the heathen, they are but silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths and speak not. Eyes have they, see not. They have ears, hear not. Neither is any breath in their mouths. And then perhaps most scarily, they that make them are like unto them, so are all they that put their trust in them. So in the psalmist's mind, okay, idols are things we make, right? Work of human hands. I am proposing to us that race is something that we made. It's a work of human hands, so to speak. If you consort with these idols, they tend to present as things that are actually, they present as seeing and hearing and any number of things. But if you consort with them, what tends to happen is you actually become diminished. You lose sort of your life, you lose your perception, you lose your speech. So you start seeing wrongly, you start speaking wrongly, you start living wrongly. The more you kind of consort with these things. And essentially what I'm proposing is exactly this is what is happening, the more this concept is central to our lives individually or in our politics, okay? But then there's a still scarier Psalm, 106. Insomuch that they worshipped their idols, which turned to their own decay. Yea, they offered their sons and daughters unto devils and shed innocent blood, even the blood of their sons and of their daughters, whom they had offered unto the idols of Canaan. And the land was defiled with blood. Thus were they stained with their own works and went a whoring with their own invention. So this brings in this theme of adultery and idolatry being kind of matched. So what I have in mind here is, at least as far as the Old Testament is concerned, human beings, right, are the icon of God, right? The Imago Dei, the Greek term, at least in the Septuagint, is akon or icon. And what I think is happening here, being described in the psalmist, by the psalmist, is idols have this way of obscuring the icon, right? We see people less clearly, we see the world less clearly. But as this is happening, or this happens precisely because we are being diminished. So idolatry sort of diminishes us as icons, okay? And icons are really meant to be things that disclose ultimately what is true, right? What is really real. They make manifest what is there. And this helps us, I think, see this theme about adultery or infidelity. Because the more you kind of consort with these idols, what tends to happen is you start figuring out ways of rationalizing why you don't see things as they are, right? That fundamentally, it might sound like it's adultery, and so it's about marriage, but it's really about fidelity to the truth. That the more you kind of get trapped into the sort of matrix of the idol, the more unfaithful to the truth you will become. And obviously, infidelity to the truth means infidelity to the one God, which means you will go a-whoring after your own inventions. Okay, so is there anything we can do about this sad state of affairs? I will say something very quick, and then we can have some questions. One of the things that Augustine, I think, offers consistently in the City of God is mercy as the true sacrifice, right? And I think partly in his mind, it's because mercy is something that is counter to the logic of envy. Envy tends to see your own advancement in the destruction of another, whereas mercy, as these quotations show, they are actually sort of identifying with someone in his woundedness or his weakness or his lowness and realizing that, well, if you can help, then you will both be better off, right? So it actually predicates your advancement on the raising of another rather than the diminishing of another. And we have in our politics this phrase continually, right? No justice, no peace. And I think Augustine would say, yeah, I think that's probably true, because for Augustine, peace is a tranquility of order. So peace is inextricably linked to justice. But I think he would also say, no mercy, no justice, okay? That there are certain evils that have been done in the world, all right? And we will not sort of get out of them unless we sort of learn a kind of politics of mercy, a politics that is not going to try and redress past evils or current evils by destroying or diminishing others, but by figuring ways to deal with the excesses and the disorders that we find in a way that actually helps kind of people be raised. So, back to the beginning and our ignoble lie. In this picture that I'm offering us, right, idols bring us under the power of demons. Okay, this is Augustine straightforwardly. And this corrupts how we speak, corrupts how we see, corrupts how we think, how we live. And it is only through right worship and a politics of mercy, which means partly that we probably need a kind of patience for the people who are under the power of the demons, even as we act to destroy the demons. And that's the very difficult thing we have to navigate, all right? That how do you destroy the demons while having compassion and desire to raise rather than conquer the people who are under the sway of these powers? Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.